Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as I constantly give you different dissertations on the importance of learning, we need to learn, pray, and act so that we can, in our appeals to heaven, we will receive the bountiful blessings that he would have for us. All that being said, as we move forward in the content, we're trying to provide you with the things you need to know. It is our intent, at least it's my intent. I don't know. I think Tammy's nodding her head. Welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
It's our intent that you take the time to read these documents, because I've highlighted in the documents what we're reading. So when you find out where we are, we're on guns on page 53 of the Massachusetts debates. We usually tell you where we are. And then that way you can start right off, go to that page, and read along. If you read and you hear Tammy reading or myself reading while we're covering content, this will give you a more profound understanding of what's significant about what we're reading. All that being said, we have to focus on full compliance with the Constitution. That's the whole point of all of this. If we don't understand the Constitution, then how can we understand what is compliance and what isn't compliance? That all makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I like to make sense. that being said, as we look at these words in the ratification debates, there is no greater descriptions. No, there's no greater elucidations, clarifications of what these lines mean in the Constitution than these documents. The ratification debates is the greatest national treasure that we possess, because it clarifies the supreme law of the land to the nth degree. And we've been living under the rule of tyrants in black robes who have been redefining the law and have basically assumed and aggrandized their role of this, the judiciary. They've aggrandized the judiciary's role. As a matter of fact, I'm going to go down a little rat hole, because in my latest article, I even go into and I cite why John Jay, who was the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, why John Jay did not want to go back to the Supreme Court, because he basically said the Constitution doesn't give us any power. It is basically, a really mind-dead job. How is it that we went from the Supreme Court being a mind-dead job that they basically had to rule on law, in fact, to where a point is now they're creating law and they're ruling us from this bench on high? How did that happen? And in this article, I am exposing line by line exactly how the Federalist Papers had basically unconstitutionally, illegally, if you understand contract law, articles in a newspaper have no legal bearing in a contract. None. These words of the ratification debates are the definitive and legal definitions and terms and stipulations of this contract. All contract law over the dispensation since the very beginning, when man came to earth and started making covenants with God, it has been understood that those stipulations during that covenant process, during the negotiations and ratification of the acceptance of the covenants or the contract, that is legally binding. Anyway, so in our appeals to heaven, learn, pray, and act, we have to demand full compliance of the Constitution and understanding that from the ratification debates is the coup d'etat, as well as running for president. If we're going to have a constitutional president, we have to dismantle the party control over the Electoral College. Because even though you may have a good state that's doing it. It is the bad states and the overall party control nationally that is ensuring that we have globalist presidents, which is why we have Trump as a globalist president in office today. We have yet to have, for a long time, a president that actually understands the Constitution and will actually use his office to help the states do their job. Anyway, I covered this several times in several over the past several years, and let's just get into the content because that's why we're here. We're here to kind of go through the content, and sometimes, you know, I like to swim in the rat holes. Anywho.
What's the article you were referring to?
This article is the follow-on to Why Counties Matter Most. And currently, I'm calling it our First Amendment right of petition, but it's far more than that. It's right now, it's going on 100 pages. It's 70-some odd pages. So
you're still writing it.
Yeah, I'm still writing it. So it's really more of a book, just like Why Counties Matter Most is a mini book, because I think it's like 70-some pages.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that these are... But what I'm trying to provide is an academic, definitive documentation of the woes and what we're experiencing and what we have to do, precisely what we have to do. Wouldn't it have been great if Madison and Jefferson, when they did the Alien and Sedition Act resolutions of 1798, if they would have sat down and wrote down what needed to happen and why it needed to happen, word for word, basically giving us, you know, a full map of what we needed to do to get the federal government into full compliance, getting the states there, everything else, and how to do it, and then roll that up and put it in a bottle and then just put, you know, in case of emergency, break glass and, you know, read here because we've got everything you need right here.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That would have been great had they done that. But one of the things they did do is they set the example. They lived by the law. They demanded adherence to the law, which is what they were doing. And over time, nobody has taken the time to extrapolate how and what to do. So that's what these articles are basically doing. I don't know why nobody else has done this. And I'll tell you why, probably, because there's no money in it. There's no money in fixing. There's more money in violating the Constitution and zero money in getting compliance. You don't walk away, just like the framers didn't walk away with these, you know, golden parachutes because of what they did in government. Their golden parachute was, you know, the honorable, you know, work that they did at their own expense, practically. They basically just got reimbursed for what they did. Their golden parachute was their names going down in the annals of history as these great noble men that actually preserved liberty for all people in this world. They set this foundation so that the Constitution could move forward and let all nations come to the knowledge of liberty. And yet... they lived in vain, maybe, because so many evil people had redirected and has literally undermined the intent that the divine hand of providence inspired them to do what they did and so forth and so on. So anywho, we're dealing with guns here. And so let's go ahead and see what Mr. Symes has to say.
All right. I humbly submit it, sir, whether if each state had its proportion of some certain gross sum assigned, according to its numbers, and a power was given to Congress to collect the same, in case of a default in the state, this would not have been a safer constitution. For, sir, I also disapprove of the power to collect, which is here vested in Congress. It is a power, sir, to burden us with a standing army of ravenous collectors, harpies, perhaps from another state, who, however, were never known to have bowels for any purpose but to fatten on the lifeblood of the people. In an age or two, this will be the case, and when the Congress shall become tyrannical, these vultures, their servants, will be the tyrants of the village, by whose presence all freedom of speech and action will be taken away.
Okay, so by what he's saying, he's basically saying that they will create a standing army to enforce taxation. And actually...
Which they have.
Well, actually, so they have. But actually, what the Constitution really did was it gave the federal government the power to form a militia. They can't form a militia to go into one state. Let's just say one state in the union doesn't want to abide by these taxes. They actually have this open rebellion against paying a particular tax. Because this is what he's talking about. He's talking about using a standing army to go into the state. Well, technically, if all the states were failing to collect the taxes, in other words, they were all revolting against the taxation, and the federal government had no constitutional standing for that tax, the states had literally and could collectively basically nullify that law by basically pursuing them to say, you don't have the authority. You can't prove that you have the authority to tax us this way. This is why we are revolting. However, this case actually proves what this man just said was wrong, because the Whiskey Rebellion occurred right after the Constitution was ratified. The federal government placed an excise tax on distilled liquors, and they started collecting. And every state in the union acknowledged that they did have the power to collect excise taxes. Why liquor? Well, because that was actually a staple of their day. You know, I know a lot of people that, you know, oh boy, I'd love to live in that day if I, you know, had to sustain myself off of liquor. You know, this distilled liquor wasn't like it is today, like, you know, Everclear or, you know, this moonshine that's almost 100% alcohol. These were, you know, low contents of bourbon and so forth and whiskey, where, you know, maybe 20-30% alcohol. So they were grain liquors that they were distilling, but they did that because you can't preserve grain juice. This is how they survived through the winter. So this grain juice with a little bit of alcohol would preserve it, so it was still consumable, because if you just had juice without actually fermenting it, you would get sick because it would rot. It could only sit for so long. Does that make sense, right? They didn't have refrigeration. Mm-hmm. They didn't have ways of making long-term storage. So wine, back in the biblical days, was one of the necessary ways of sustaining themselves, along with grain, right, making bread, and so forth. And so they actually started expanding their drinks so that they could get nutrients for more than just grapes and bread. So nevertheless, they created this whiskey tax. Now, we're actually going to cover this in content. We covered it last year, and I think you might have covered it with me. But in this whiskey rebellion, who did the federal government call for standing up the militia? Well, the whiskey rebellion was in the western portions of the Pennsylvania Territory, Ohio, and beyond. So, and they weren't states. There was kind of a territory area where they're trying to collect these taxes, and in the Pittsburgh area, around that area, and west. So bottom line, the federal government federalized four, what they ended up doing in 1794, federalized four state militias, Pennsylvania being one of them. He's saying that they would come from another state. No, actually, Pennsylvania was one of them, because Pennsylvania was trying to actually enforce this legitimate tax. And so they ended up adding, I believe, New Jersey, Maryland, and Virginia, all neighboring states, because why go all the way down to South Carolina or Georgia to haul them all the way up to go into Pennsylvania? They went to the easy states so it would be easy to deploy to enough force to go into western Pennsylvania, and they arrested 24 men who were caught, you know, damaging property and so forth in their protest, and said, hey, look, you can't do this. You cannot protest legitimate law. As a matter of fact, when we get to the Virginia ratification base, I'm going to prove to you that they saw this riotous behavior as unconstitutional, as illegal, and could not be acceptable. That's why they gave us the right to assemble and petition government for the redress of grievances, not to get out in the street and start burning. So when you look at what he's calling for here, He's basically saying that the federal government would ultimately violate the Constitution and create a standing army. So technically, when we look at the fact that a standing army exists, that today is a violation of the Constitution. We're supposed to willingly submit to these lawful acts of taxation. The only reason that they have a standing army is because most of the taxation is not lawful. Because they're taxing us for money that they're spending without the constitutional authority to spend it.
Right.
So the federal government created the IRS to basically be highway bandits to actually take away our money so they could still spend us into oblivion unconstitutionally. And technically, the fact that they created the IRS instead of using the state's militias to enforce these laws would have actually stopped them from being able to spend the money. Had the states actually stood up at this point in time, because they became so illiterate on the Constitution and they never really looked historically how everything laid out and how they kind of dealt with these initial problems, would have clearly made connected all the dots for them to where they'd say, hey, you can't be doing this. So as we kind of, as we go down to the next one, which are corporations, Mr. Jones of Boston talks a little bit about the forming of corporations and so forth. So let's go ahead and dive into this.
Okay. Enlarged on the various checks which the Constitution provides, and which he said formed a security for liberty and prevention against power being abused, the frequency of elections of the democratic branch, representation apportioned to numbers, the publication of the journals of Congress, etc., and gentlemen, he said, had compared the people of this country to those of Rome. But he observed the comparison was very erroneous. The Romans were divided into two classes, the nobility and the plebeians.
Plebeians,
the
yes.
The nobility kept all kinds of knowledge to their own class, and the plebeians were in general very ignorant, and when unemployed in time of peace, were ever ready for revolt and to follow the dictates of any designing patrician.
Mm-hmm.
But continued the worthy gentleman, the people of the United States are an enlightened, well-informed people and are therefore not easily imposed on by designing men. Our right of representation, concluded Mr. Jones, is much more just and equitable than the boasted one of Great Britain, whose representatives are chosen by corporations or bureaus, and those bureaus in general are the property or at the disposal of the nobility and rich gentry of the kingdom.
Right, so he's basically laying out that when we look at the House of Commons, when we look at the House of Lords, it's really not an election of the people, where it is being done, as he points out at the very beginning, through a democratic process, that the people get to choose their representatives, both at the federal level, at the state level, and at the county level. They are to be represented by these lawmakers at all three levels of our government. This is why we have a voice in every level. This three-tiered hybrid constitutional republic, where you actually have a national republic of states and a state republic of counties, where we actually get representation at all three levels. The state level should be a general government with limited powers. The federal government is a general government with very limited powers, and all powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states and the people. Same thing with the states, that general government, the powers delegated to it, you know, to do what it needs to do in serving the counties, and all powers not delegated to it should be reserved to the counties and their citizens thereof. So, as we lay through this, he's pointing out how corporations are literally these entities that begin to undermine a society. So, as we go down to Mr. Pierce on the next day, which is January 23rd. I wonder how cold it was in Massachusetts on this day. Probably pretty cold. So anyway, these are impost and direct taxes, and we kind of have this section in the first paragraph thereof, and we kind of keep on going. And as you notice, there's all of this conversation. Now, for the most part, I believe we kind of covered this. If you go down to Mr. Choate, remember Mr. Choate? You remember that name?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so I believe we kind of covered all of this. And General Thompson was an anti-federalist. This is why I kind of highlighted what he was trying to point out, because what he was really doing was very detailed and a long assertion. But you have to be weary of the people and how they were talking, because as we just listened regarding the guns, Mr. Symes was an anti-federalist as well. And his assertion as he was making, oh, well, they're going to do this. Actually, if they did that, they would be violating the Constitution. So if we go down a little bit further, there's the Honorable Mr. Bowdoin and the taxation and the falling of the Confederation. This is all about the currency and how the state's paper money was such a huge problem. This is where we actually start learning how important it is that the federal government maintain a currency of gold and silver, not printed money. These men warned us not to go down these paths by actually ingraining it to the federal government that they could only do these things. The only way the federal government can actually use paper, a paper currency, is to amend the Constitution. And folks, there is no amendment. This goes back to another huge violation of the Constitution. And so I've been haranguing and harping on there's these efforts of a county convention. And you don't know this, Tammy, but in the state of Washington, there is an effort to actually call out, you know, the county representation, because the apportionment designed in the state constitution was that the counties were to have representation. That's how it was designed, mm-hmm. just like in Wyoming. And the problem is that that's the only thing that they're trying to do. They don't care about the fact that we don't have a gold currency. They only want to restore the constitutional representation of the county in the state senate. Well, that'd be nice, but that doesn't fix a lot of our problems. It doesn't. I mean, we have so many much more important, like the spending, the currencies. I mean, there are so many different things that are happening. We're being attacked in so many different ways that the time being spent on trying to invoke a state constitutional convention with something that won't really fix a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll only fix one little problem, but it doesn't fix everything else. There's so many. And so it is my conjecture that for that actually to be restored, if they actually have a constitutional convention for the state of Washington to restore apportionment back to the counties, I believe the political compromise would be that they cannot form another constitutional convention for 20, 30, 40 years, because that's a common clause that they have in every state. New York actually has a clause that says every 20 years a vote needs to go to the people to determine whether the state needs to have a constitutional convention or not.
I didn't know that.
Right. And so I'm basically injecting this, that there's going to be some kind of political compromise that is going to undermine what they're really doing. They may get, but it'll be a pirate. If you've ever heard of the term, folks, a pirate's victory, it means that, yeah, you won the battle. You may have won the war, but you've been so decimated, you have no capacity to even enjoy the spoils of that, you know, win, or, you know, what you had ended up doing. And so as we'll get into this section when we come back, but I just wanted to kind of talk about, you know, this putting putting context to these constitutional conventions or these county conventions regarding the taxation, so many of other problems. We'll be right back after this. I'll make it all sense.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Yeah, so sometimes I have to hurry my speech so much that I actually kind of disform it. That's my dyslexia. So I'll make sense of it all when we come back. So be wary of these myopic organizations. Be wary of anybody that's not really out to fix the entire problem. We have a huge mess, folks. We all need to get resolved, roll up our sleeves, and we all need to dive into the full, complete fix. And it has to start with your county constitutional conventions, where you actually lay out. And so we're hoping to do this for you in Washington State, but we're being undermined by supposedly a conservative effort, but it's actually not conservative. This is how the progressives basically hijack by injecting, it's called controlled opposition. And so whether the persons doing this are literally on their own because they're seeking their own self-gratification, like money. Because a lot of times that's what, why would anybody do this? Well, either for self-recognition or to actually inject money into their political causes so that they can gain political clout. Does that make sense, Tammy?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah, totally.
And you probably see this in Wyoming. These people go out and they go, hey, you know what? We don't have this medical freedom movement. So somebody starts creating that. They start working together. Hey, you're doing this and we're doing this. So let's make this national. And then we can start infusing, getting more money from other, you know, other donors and so forth, because that's what they do. It's all about the money. It's all about the recognition. It's all about an agenda. It's not about fixing the problem, because fixing the problem is a lot more than just one little patch. A lot more. And it's
not...
Do you
think that they don't really realize that, though? I mean, I think a lot of them are sincere in their efforts.
Regarding this particular agenda, I actually went through the details of the individual spearheading this. And I'm not going to mention his name, but bottom line, I laid it out. You're making a huge mistake, and I'm not going to support this. You know, this will actually help you. And no, it doesn't help me. It actually is a huge distraction, and he knows this. So regardless of how you want to split the atom here, you're still creating an atomic bomb. And the destruction that you will cause will not actually solve any problems. So, bottom line, as we go back into this taxation and the failing of the Confederation, how the money and so forth became really a problem, let's go ahead and dive into what Mr. Bowden... Now, I don't know if he was a reverend or not, but most people were way leaders in, I mean, the Puritan faith, the way Massachusetts was laid out, they had a lot of different way leaders. And so there were honorable reverends, and I think that they were large congregational leaders that, had other way leaders or other small congregations underneath them and so forth. But anyway, nevertheless, as you go through this, and I've said this before, you're going to see a far more spiritual attitude and a mind's eye of how they looked at the Constitution. So let's go ahead and read this. Okay. Taxation and the Failing of the Confederation.
Okay, in considering it, every gentleman will reflect how inadequate to the purpose of the Union the Confederation has been. When the plan of the Confederation was formed, the enemy were invading us, and this inspired the several states with such a spirit of union and mutual defense that a mere requisition or recommendation of Congress was sufficient to procure the needful aids without any power of coercion, and for that reason, among others, no such power was given by the Confederation. But since that reason bad seized, and the idea of danger being removed by the peace, the requisitions of Congress have, in most of the states, been little regarded, notwithstanding they solemnly pledged their faith to comply with them.
Okay, since that reason had ceased, that's just a typo.
Oh, okay, that's a typo. Okay, yep. Gotcha. This non-compliance has compelled Congress to increase the foreign debt of the Union by procuring further loans to pay the interest and installments due on former loans, and in that way to preserve the public faith which had been pledged to foreign powers. It has compelled them, in order to prevent the consequences of a breach of faith as relative to those powers, to enter repeatedly into those reunions, ruinous negotiations, by which the United States jointly, and each of them in particular, together with all their lands, chattels, revenues and products, and also the imposts and taxes already laid and raised in the same, or in time to come to be laid and raised, are for the whole mortgaged for the repayment of those loans by installments and for the payment of the interest on them annually. These debts must be paid bona fide according to contract, or be further increased by procuring, if procurable, further loans, which, ruinous as the measure is, must be continued unless the states empower Congress to raise money for the discharging of those debts.
Okay, so right here, so hold on, okay, hold on real soon. I apologize for being a little slow in interrupting you. What we're looking at right here is that they laid it out that they were in such a desperate need regarding the debt that they were leveraging like mortgages, and that's what they were laying it out. They together their lands, chattels, the people, revenues and products, and also imposts and taxes already laid and raised the same. So they were creating, they were leveraging and mortgaging the United States to these foreign nations if they would not pay their debt. They were getting to a point where had we not started honoring that debt, they would be able to foreclose on America, because the states were not allowing that debt. Because what happened, they inherited this problem. And the states, because the states refused to actually pay, some states did, but most of the other states didn't, they had already set in motion, because of the necessity of paying debt, they had to start literally laying out these mortgages. There were some states that actually paid their debt, and I think they were absolved of those costs. But all these other states and the Continental Congress were still, you know, basically hamstrung over the barrel. Bottom line, we were in a position that moving forward, because they didn't see the pending revolution in France, they didn't see the rising of Napoleon Bonaparte, who would look at America, where we felt we had a common ally and a true friend in France. Bonaparte wasn't going to be our friend anymore. He was going to be our ruler, because had we not started paying France, he would have turned his focus onto America instead of Russia, instead of the other nobilities in Europe. He would have come to America first and seized us and basically subjugated us. Hmm. And we would have gone from one frying pan into the fire. This was the peril of the Union under the Articles of Confederation. I can't emphasize this enough. And but believe me, folks, I will, every time these things come up, I'm going to lay this out, that nobody saw France just around the corner, and how had we not had this Constitutional Convention and actually alleviated this by starting to pay our debt, boy, the divine hand of providence saved us. And people, there's people today that are calling for, oh, we got to get back to the Articles of Confederation. What lunacy is that?
Yeah, no kidding.
Okay, so my apologies, but go ahead and start again where you left off. It will not in the power.
Okay. Yeah, it will not be in the power of the United States, and I am sure it will not be in their inclination to rid themselves of those debts in the same base and ignominious manner in which a faction in one of them are endeavoring to rid of theirs. To the same cause, a non-compliance with congressional requisitions are owing the repeated but necessary breaches of public faith in regard to the payment of the federal domestic debt. And hence, as relative to the joint consolidated debt, the inefficiency of the public finances and the bankrupt state of the federal treasury, which can never be remedied without empowering Congress to levy adequate duties and taxes. Without such a power, the accumulating debt will never be paid, but by a forcible collection, which our foreign creditors know how and are able to apply if unhappily it should be necessary. The several loans by which contracts are to be paid by installment will, in case of the failure of any of the stipulated payments, become the whole of them, immediately payable, and any of the property of any of the states, whether public or private, that can be most easily come at, will, in that case, be seized and applied for that purpose.
Yeah, keep going. I'm sorry.
This mode of reimbursement or reprisal will be upon the trade and navigation of the United States, and in proportion as ours of this state may be larger and more extensive than the trade and navigation of other states, we shall be the greatest sufferers. This ruin of our trade will involve in it not only the ruin of the mercantile part of the state and of the numerous body of mechanics dependent upon it, but will also essentially affect every other class of citizens and operate most extensively to the injury of the commonwealth. But if we attend to our trade, as it is at present, we shall find that the miserable state of it is owing to a like want of power in Congress. Other nations prohibit our vessels from entering their ports, or lay heavy duties on our exports carried thither, and we have no retaliating or regulating power over their vessels and exports to prevent it. Hence a decrease of our commerce and navigation, and the duties and revenue arising from them. Hence an insufficient demand for the produce of our lands, and the consequent discouragement of agriculture. Hence the inability to pay debts, and particularly taxes, which by that decrease are enhanced. And hence, as the necessary result of all these, the immigration of our inhabitants. If it be asked, how are these evils and others that might be mentioned to be remedied? The answer is short, by giving Congress adequate and proper power. Whether such power be given by the proposed Constitution, it is left with the conventions from the several states, and with us who compose one of them, to determine.
Okay, so he lays out right there how they are in a downward spiral. It's just going down because the ports, foreign ports, are not receiving their commerce. So we don't have any influx of any revenues at all. So what's happening to the crops that they're growing? Because they're perishable. What's happening in America is this very... They were at the brink of destruction. They realized how close they were at failing and being literally moved into conservatorship by probably France and Holland, because those were the two nations, I think, that we owed the most to. Not Britain. Those two nations. So with Napoleon coming around the corner, and I believe that down the road, you know, we started trying to amend things, but bottom line, down the road, I don't think that we really created too much debt with England. I don't think we did. Hmm. We might have, but I just think that that was only because we were starting to spread our wings, because we were focused in trying to pay off our debt. And guess what happened? Under Thomas Jefferson's presidency, they did pay off the debt. And at that same time, in so doing, they basically disbanded the National Bank. Mm-hmm. And then Madison had to resurrect the second charter of the National Bank, even though they worked hard in paying off the debt. I mean, if you go into anything that talks about the first two national charters, it points out that under Jefferson and Madison, that presidency of Jefferson, because Madison was the Secretary of State, they were focused in getting rid of that bank. And then when England attacked, it forced Madison to create a new charter, but he did not create the same kind of beast that was created by Alexander Hamilton, where they were creating all these products and bonds and these schemes of interest. That wasn't done. And Madison actually baked into the plan of, you know, borrowing money from other nations to fight England again, where they were going to pay that debt off quickly, and they did. And the guy that enjoyed and basically claimed, you know, he did it was Andrew Jackson took all the credit for paying off the debt. When Monroe talks about during his presidency that they were well ahead of schedule in being able to pay off that huge debt of borrowing so that we could fight England once again. Technically, you would think that we would have had, I believe, because we beat them, we would have had the upper hand to go after them to say, you owe us financially for the damages you caused by attacking us. We mm-hmm. never did that, because I think we just wanted to move on and kind of leave that alone. But I think there should have been an appeal to basically say, you know, England, we had our independence and you violated that. And you actually waged war against us again and laid that out there as a financial leverage in the international community to basically be acknowledged that that debt is there. You know, if we didn't claim it at that point in time, we'd at least make the mark there so that we say, hey, we got this mark on you. Start messing with us some more. We're going to demand you basically compensate us for the damages of destroying Washington, D.C., anyway, okay, so in determining, go ahead, keep on going.
In determining on this question, every gentleman will, doubtless, consider the importance of cultivating a spirit of union among ourselves and with the several states. This spirit procured our emancipation from British tyranny, and the same spirit, by uniting us in the necessary means, must secure to us our dear-bought, blood-purchased liberty and independence, and deliver us from evils which, unless remedied, must end in national ruin. The means for effecting these purposes are within our reach, and the adoption of the proposed Constitution will give us the possession of them. Like all human productions, it may be imperfect, but most of the imperfections imputed to it are ideal and unfounded, and the rest are such a nature that they cannot be certainly known but by the operations of the Constitution. And if, in its operation, it should in any respect be essentially bad, it will be amended in one of the models prescribed by it. I say will be amended, because the Constitution is constructed on such principles that its bad effects, if any such should arise from it, will injure the members of Congress equally with their constituents, and therefore both of them must be equally induced to seek for and effectuate, if possible, the requisite amendments.
There you go. And once again, they're making comment that Congress cannot immune themselves from their own hand. And that's what they're laying out here. That's why he says, I say will be amended, because the Constitution is constructed on such principles that its bad effects, if any such should arise from it, will injure the members of Congress equally with their constituents, mm-hmm. and therefore. So that's why I'm saying that right there is another basic assertion that Congress cannot, because they're not immune from this, from the Constitution, from their own hands, by creating their own laws. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. There have been many objections offered against the Constitution, and of these, one of the most strongly urged has been the great power vested in Congress. On this subject, I beg leave to make a few general observations which ought to be attended to as being applicable to every branch of that power. It may therefore be observed that the investiture of such power, so far from being an objection, is a most cogent reason for accepting the Constitution. The power of Congress, both in the legislative and executive lines, is the power of the people, collected through a certain medium to a focal point, at all times ready to be exerted for the general benefit, according as circumstances or exigencies may require. If you diminish or annihilate it, you diminish or annihilate the means of your own safety and prosperity, which means, if they were to be measured like mathematical quantities, would be in exact proportion, as the power is greater or less. But this is not the case, for power that does not reach or is inadequate to the object is worse than none. An exertion of such power would increase the evil it was intended to remove, and at the same time create a further evil which might be a very great one, the expense of a fruitless exertion.
Okay.
If we consider the objects of the power, they are numerous and important, and as human foresight cannot extend to many of them, and all of them are in the womb of futurity, the quantum of the power cannot be estimated. Less than the whole, as a relative to federal purposes, may, through its insufficiency, occasion the dissolution of the Union and the subjugation or division of it among foreign powers. Their attention is drawn to the United States. Their emissaries are watching our conduct, particularly upon the present most important occasion, and if we should be so unhappy as to reject the federal Constitution proposed to us and continue much longer our present weak, unenergetic federal government, their policy will probably induce them to plan a division or partition of the states among themselves and unite their forces to effect it.
So he just basically dropped the bomb there. He says that right now they're watching us. Their attention is drawn to the United States. Their emissaries are watching our conduct, particularly upon the present most important occasion. And if we should be so unhappy as to reject this federal constitution proposed to us and continue much longer our present weak, unenergetic federal government, because he's talking about the current Continental Congress as their federal government, their policy will probably induce them to plan a division or partition of the states among themselves and unite their forces to effect it. So they were basically saying, this is going to happen. They're watching us. And it would have happened as fast as that it would have kicked off from that French Revolution of 1790. Right? I mean, that was only 2 years from this point when the French Revolution kicked off and they started chopping heads off in France. So, as we go down to him, a little more, he goes and starts talking about delegated. Go ahead.
It will be, and has been said, this great power may be abused, and instead of protecting, may be employed by Congress in oppressing their constituents. A possibility of abuse, as it may be affirmed, of all delegated power, whatever is by itself no sufficient reason for withholding the delegation. If it were a sufficient one, no power could be delegated, nor could government of any sort subsist. The possibility, however, should make us careful that in all delegations of importance, like the one contained in the proposed Constitution, there should be such checks provided as would not frustrate the end and intention of delegating the power, but would, as far as it could be safely done, prevent the abuse of it, and such checks, are provided in the Constitution. Some of them were mentioned the last evening by one of my worthy colleagues, but I shall here exhibit all of them in one view. The two capital departments of government, the legislative and executive, in which the delegated power resides, consisting of the President, Vice President, Senate, and Representatives, are directly and by the respective legislatures and delegates chosen by the people.
Okay, at that point right there, he's basically saying this is where the people have basically invested their energy. Notice that the court's not mentioned. Again, it goes down that path of John Jay, seeing that the court is a very passive, impotent court. It basically, the cases come to them. They can't go and step in and say, hey, you can't do these things, or try to make leverage from one case to another, like they did with Baker v. Carr, Reynolds v. Sims, and so forth. And so this has to really... Folks, you got to start getting this. The court today is exercising so many powers they don't have. And they were the ones that actually opened the can of worms and have put us in all of these bad situations, because they've assumed the power to legislate and rule us. Go ahead.
Not only that, people just assume that they are the highest power.
Yes, yes. Well, that's because they told us they were.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
The president and also the vice president, when acting as president, before they enter on the execution of the office, shall each solemnly swear or affirm that he will faithfully execute the office of the president of the United States and will, to the best of his ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Okay.
The senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the state legislatures and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution.
All right.
President and...
Go ahead.
The President and Vice President and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes or misdemeanors. No senator or representative shall, during the time for which he was elected, be appointed to any civil office which shall have been created, or the emoluments whereof shall have been increased during such time, and no person holding any office under the United States shall be a member of either house during his continuance in office. No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States or by any particular state, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States shall, without the consent of the Congress, except of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state.
Okay, so what they did right there, so what they were doing right there.
Okay.
They were literally laying it out by these oaths and so forth. What they were doing was making it so that nobody could actually assume extra offices, nor could any United States citizen become elevated by titles of nobility in any way. And as a matter of fact, they ended up creating an amendment that actually made it impossible for anybody to have an elevation to be a citizen in the United States. So with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help, and we'll have Tammy back to finish this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.